This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices Energy Week, Episode 7, was recorded on Wednesday, June 19th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. I'll be joined this week by HedgeEye Energy Markets Research Chief Joe McMonagle, author and consultant Anas Alhaji, and commercial broker Pat Hemsworth. Our topics this week include the attacks on oil tankers in the Gulf, the upcoming OPEC meeting, resumption of trade talks between the U.S. and China, the G20 and Fed policy, and the outlook for 2020 and beyond, and the bearish perspective in the IEA forecast. But first, let's dive right into this week's EIA inventory and production data. Crude oil drawing down 3.1 million barrels nationally and ending a streak of builds over the last several weeks. But Cushing, Oklahoma, still building this week, 643,000 barrels. So not as big of a build as we've seen for the last couple of weeks, but a build just the same. Gasoline building 147,000 barrels, distillates drawing down 551,000 barrels. The tape action was a pop up initially to range resistance, right around the five-week moving average at 54.65 on the August WTI contract. After testing that number on the inventory data, there was a pretty quick retracement back down almost to the same numbers that we saw before the data came out, and then a slow, gradual rise back up, accelerating after the pit close, and eventually around 4 p.m., moving above that 54.65 level just very briefly. U.S. production ticked down 100,000 barrels to 12.2 million barrels. Not quite reason for concern yet, but a lot of analysts have predicted, based on declining rig counts, that we would eventually see a drop-off on U.S. shale production in particular. So we need to keep a close eye on this 12.2 number. If it drops back below 12 million barrels, I might start to get concerned that we are seeing that trend reversal so many people have anticipated. Imports, 7.4 million barrels per day last week. Exports moving up to a massive 3.4 million barrels. That's 24 million barrels on the week exported in terms of U.S. oil, leaving that 3.1 million barrel drawdown after those 24 million barrels were exported. Now let's meet this week's expert panel. Dr. Anas Alhaji is an author, keynote speaker, and energy markets expert. He was formerly the chief economist for NGP Energy Capital Management and also taught energy economics at the University of Oklahoma and Colorado School of Mines. Anas, what impact have the oil tanker attacks had on instability in the Gulf, and what are the implications for the future of the oil market? Will these events lead to major changes in the industry?
Yes, they do. But first, let me kind of set up for the discussion. President Trump visited Japan and asked Shinzo Abe, that was 3 weeks ago, he asked Shinzo Abe, the prime minister of Japan, to go to Tehran to mediate between his administration and the Iranian regime on the hope to have direct dialogue between the two countries. While Abe was in Tehran, the attacks on the two ships took place. One carrying naphtha going to Japan and the other one carrying methanol, although it's not going to Japan, it was owned by a Japanese company. So the timing and the targets cannot be a coincidence. That means someone wants to derail Abe's efforts. Someone who wants to make sure negotiations between the U.S. and Iran will not happen. While there is a list of possible suspects, it is clear that the IRG, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, which is, by the way, it's not part of the government. So it's part of the regime, but it's not part of the government, tops the list. They will do whatever to derail such negotiations. It is clear that the Iranian government is under a lot of political and economic pressure, while the IRG and the Supreme Leader are not. The attacks and whatever might follow, such as continued attacks on tankers, airstrikes against Iranian targets or even a war is against the interests of the countries around the Gulf. Let's take Saudi Arabia, for example. Saudi Arabia, to some extent, the United Arab Emirates, established themselves as reliable and dependable suppliers of energy. Any attacks or disruptions in the Gulf or the Hormuz Strait caused by anyone harm the strategic objective of those two countries. The instability in the Middle East, and this is to answer your question directly, we will hear calls by politicians and policymakers in Europe, the United States, and probably Asia to reduce dependence on oil imports from the region. This is not good for Saudi Arabia and its allies. We will see politicians and policymakers in Europe, the United States, and Asia, probably even Africa, calling for eliminating dependence on oil altogether, something the Saudis do not want to see. We have enough evidence in the last 50 years to prove these points. It is clear that most oilers are aware of these issues, and this might force a mild response from Saudi Arabia or the UAE. So we may not see a strong response. Whatever response is going to be extremely mild for fear that this is going to derail their market share in the future. Continued attacks in the Gulf will change one more time crude and trade patterns, because we've seen those changes in the past. We will also see Saudi Arabia and its allies in the Gulf building more pipelines to circumvent the Hormuz Strait. Iraq and Qatar will get stuck with no pipelines. Iraq basically have to be aligned with the Gulf to get pipelines. Qatar LNG cannot go through pipelines. Finally, Eric, here is the problem. Expanding pipelines may not help, since the attacks happened outside the Gulf, and like in the Gulf of Oman or near Fujairah, and on the Saudi pipelines in the middle of the desert. So the reputational damage already happened and might get larger in the future, despite the incredible efforts by those governments to ensure reliable supplies to the world. The bottom line is, continued instability means consuming countries will lower imports from the Gulf, will give another reason to lower dependence on oil, and will change the patterns of trade in oil and other products.
Thanks for your perspective on that, Anas. I wanted to start with you because this topic has obviously got everyone's attention. We'll come back to it again as our first discussion topic with the rest of the panel. But first, let's meet the rest of the panel. Pat Hemsworth is a commercial broker with Paragon Global Markets, and her decades of experience in both the paper and physical markets give her tremendous insight into the dependencies that exist between markets. And Pat, that's exactly what I want to talk about, is those dependencies. The market is in a tug of war between macroeconomic factors, which so far have been a negative influence on oil prices, and growing geopolitical risk in the Gulf, which, needless to say, creates upward pressure on prices. But under the surface of flat price crude movement, we've had major shifts in crude forward curves and product markets, as well as major shifts in fund positioning. Pat, what are your comments about these recent developments?
Just to start out with like a segue from Anas's comment, just reviewing what we've seen over the last few weeks, we absolutely collapsed initially with the S&P, but this was on the threats of more tariffs, the stalling of the Chinese trade talks, as well as the threats of Mexican tariffs. And so with the S&P, the oil market collapsed and from top to bottom went $14. And before, okay, this is really in the course of 3 weeks. So what we have seen since then is a major shift in spread relationships, exposure of hedge funds. And also, we're coming out of the turnaround season in the United States and also in Asia and in Europe. And so, you know, we're starting to see that shift in the United States. For instance, today we saw that the runs were up 0.7%. And so we're starting to get close to where, you know, to a normal level for this time of year. But what we've seen since the drop in the market is a major shift in the exposure of hedge funds. We've had an almost 80,000, this is just WTI in 2 weeks, an 80,000 lot liquidation of long positions by funds. We also saw the same thing with gas oil. We saw the same thing. Okay, just last week, gas oil in London was down 40,000. As far as RBOB, we're down somewhat in heating oil here or ultra low sulfur diesel. Funds are actually short right now, and they're building short positions. So we've had a major shift in market structure and also exposure of and involvement of hedge funds. Now, hedge funds have not completely liquidated their positions in commodities and gone away in a total risk-off position. They have taken their money and gone into gold and also into grains, but they have really significantly reduced exposure in commodities. We've also seen a major shift in the Brent market, the front month Brent market. The spread between, well, first it was July, August, and then July went off the board, and we continued to get very, very strong movement in those spreads, a very, very strong backwardation. In fact, last week we traded to $1.49 at a high in August, September, and that was due to multiple planned and unplanned outages in North Sea production, as well as the chaos created by the contamination of Russian Urals. But gradually, that situation has been mitigated, and the production in the North Sea is gradually coming back. And so we're seeing those spreads come in. Today we came in, I believe we closed somewhere around 74 after being at 149 last week. So we're getting a shift there. We were in backwardation in gas oil. That now is in a contango. And we're seeing also in the United States, we're seeing change in the spreads also as we come back from turnarounds. The gasoline report today was pretty bullish. Well, friendly, let's put it that way. Demand showed 9.98 million barrels a day of gasoline consumption, which is pretty good. So we recovered somewhat. But since we started to come back, say July gasoline cracks went down to $18 this morning and then rallied a dollar on the report today. So what we're seeing anyways is a shift in exposure of hedge funds. We're seeing a shift in market shape, and we're also seeing a change in the product markets as we come back from turnarounds.
Okay, thanks for that, Pat. Let's move on to Joe McMonagle, a former chief of staff at the U.S. Department of Energy and former vice chairman of the International Energy Agency. Joe regularly attends OPEC meetings, at least the ones where they can make up their mind what day the meeting is happening, and is a frequent commentator on oil markets for many major media outlets. Joe, we finally have confirmation, I think, that the meeting dates for OPEC will be July 1st and 2nd, after weeks of delay and indecision. As a OPEC watcher who attends the meetings personally and talks behind the scenes with various ministry officials, I'm wondering what you are expecting the outcome to be from this meeting. If OPEC can't seem to agree on a meeting date, are they going to be able to agree on production policy?
Well, thanks, Eric. First, let me say it's a pleasure to be on with my friends Anas and Pat, who I respect their views tremendously. Getting on to your question, I mean, the meeting was supposed to be for actually next week, June 26th and 27th. So in my view, we're not only going to have a rollover of the meeting date, but very likely a rollover of production cuts, which expire on June 30th. I think most of the blame here is going to Iran for the meeting date uncertainty, but it was really Russia that asked to move the meeting a month ago to July 3rd and 4th at the JMMC meeting in Jeddah. The Saudis agreed to move the date mainly because they view Russia's continued cooperation, albeit in my view mostly symbolic, as critical to managing oil markets and for oil market sentiment. But Iran and other countries opposed moving the date, but ultimately Iran became the lone holdout, and then the focus went on them. Iran suggested moving the dates to mid-July, but a compromise was reached in the last 24 hours to have the dates on July 1st and 2nd. So while I think OPEC should have stuck with its original dates in late June and just told Russia to live with it, I blame most of the delay on busy schedules of ministers. And I'm not sure I really agree with some of the commentary that it hints of problems with OPEC unity. But the meeting dates are really a sideshow. The main show is the production policy decision and outcomes. And here I think there are really only two questions. One is, what will the duration of the cut extension be? And two, will Russia comply? And I think both are interrelated. First, it looks like Russia has agreed to the rollover as a result of Saudi Minister Al-Fallah's trip to Russia a couple weeks ago. One of the outcomes was an announcement of a Putin trip to Saudi Arabia in October. And in my view, I don't think this announcement would have been made unless Russia had agreed in principle to a rollover. And it's important because Russian energy companies don't like these production cuts. And it's also a growing concern, not just for the Russian energy companies, but for increasingly more Russian government officials who view surging U.S. production past Russia as now the world's number one producer as a threat to both energy dominance and also to market share. And so, you know, Putin is kind of a wild card here because he likes the world stage, and you know, that comes with partnering with Saudi Arabia on oil market management. But I think he too is also starting to get concerned about U.S. production and also price impacts on the Russian economy. But I, you know, at the end of the day, I think there's a tacit agreement between the Saudis and Russians that got Russia to yes on a rollover, and that's that Russia can have sort of a flexible compliance, even more so than has been their history to date. You know, only recently in May, they complied with the December agreement. And I think, as a lot of people pointed out, that's only because of the problems that they had with the pipeline. You know, the Russian companies really want to hike production. So, well, I think Russia agrees to a rollover in principle and as a sign of unity and a hat tip to Saudi Arabia. We'll have to watch closely again in terms of compliance in the months ahead. On the question about the length of the cut extension, it's hard to see it going more than 6 months due to Russia's concerns about even extending the cuts now. You know, I certainly think a longer extension would be more bullish for prices, or even as the Algerians sort of floated last week, you know, maybe even deeper cuts. But I think that's hard for the Russians to agree to or go along with. Plus, a six-month extension coincides with OPEC's regular meeting schedule, you know, every 6 months, and the next meeting would be in early December. So in my view, it's a rollover of the existing deal for another 6 months, and we'll revisit it again at that time.
Thanks, Joe. We'll dive into our first discussion topic, the attacks on oil tankers in the Gulf, right after this. For our first major discussion topic this week, we're going to examine last week's attacks on two crude oil tankers near the Straits of Hormuz. President Trump promptly tweeted that this attack had Iran written all over it. And soon thereafter, U.S. officials declared authoritatively that their investigation had determined conclusively that Iran was to blame for the attacks. But quite a few analysts have observed that Iran would have to be incredibly stupid to provoke a military conflict, while other nations had plenty to gain from such an outcome. So it's crystal clear that these attacks had Iran, quote, written all over them. But who did the writing? Did Iran really do this, or could it have been some sort of false flag event designed to set Iran up to take the fall? And what are the longer-term implications for energy security? We heard Anas's perspective on some aspects of this at the beginning of the show. Let's go to Joe McMonagle next. Joe, how do you see this situation? Did Iran do this, or did somebody set them up?
Well, you know, I think this is kind of typical oil market speculation that you see, not just in this case, but in other cases. To me, I think it's really surprising to see so many question Iran's involvement in the tanker attacks. Certainly, I take the point it's not in Iran's interest, but that doesn't mean Iran is not behind the attacks, or their acolytes are, or elements of the regime are. I think U.S. intelligence agencies have no doubt about that question. So why? I mean, U.S. sanctions are really starting to bite Iran as they see their customers fall one by one. This afternoon, the Wall Street Journal has an article about the Italian firm Eni rejecting a cargo of crude marketed as Iraqi crude that they determined the properties were too similar to Iranian crude. So, you know, some of this black market stuff that the market has been speculating about, we're starting to see that now implicated. And so that shipment was just rejected. And I think you're going to see more of that as the U.S. starts to clamp down more and have not granted the waivers. And so I think the Iranians want to start spreading the herd around. And so while the U.S. has a maximum pressure policy for Iran, I think Iran has now decided it's going to create a maximum geopolitical chaos plan for the Gulf. And I think Iran thinks, number one, higher prices will hurt Trump politically and may even impact his decisions on increasing pressure or perhaps to revisit the waivers or some of the moves that they're doing with the military. But I think Iran's policy now is the U.S. policy on Iran is sort of standing alone from the price discussion. So ultimately, I think this, at least on the price component, I think that's a misjudgment on Iran's part. But I think they think if you create enough chaos in the region and sort of spread this herd around, it will influence U.S. policy and Trump's thinking because they think, A, Trump has said repeatedly he doesn't want a war, and two, he doesn't want to see higher oil prices. So I think at the price point, they're kind of misunderstanding him. The war discussion is another thing, but you know, I think there's other ways the U.S. can respond, and maybe the U.S. gets to test out some of their offensive cyber attack capabilities. But in any event, I think U.S. officials on the price discussion, the reason it's separate, I think, is because U.S. officials believe that there's a cushion now with spare capacity and also with record U.S. production to mitigate any price hikes.
Thanks, Joe. Pat Hemsworth, what are you hearing with respect to all of the aftermath in the markets from the tanker attacks?
Well, basically, my approach is to look at the price and to see how the market's reacting. And we really did not rally very much. We did not even break the highs from the Sunday when the announcement of the Mexican tariffs would not happen. That went up to 54.84. We did not even break that. So the market collectively is not at this moment taking this terribly seriously. In fact, maybe it arrested what was looking like it might continue to go lower. But, you know, I think at this moment, people are, they're concerned, but I don't think that the market is registering a crisis. I may be wrong about that. I'm just looking at the market movement.
Okay. And Anas, what are your reactions to what Joe and Pat have said? We heard a little bit from you.
Well, I heard what Joe said about the supposedly to be a Nigerian oil and then an Iraqi oil and then an Iranian oil. That just won me a steak dinner, right? Joe and I, basically, we have this back and forth about ability of Iran to export oil in various ways. And this confirmed our previous discussions on this show that Iran has several games to play. Anyway, there are a couple of issues. First issue is, we heard about the tanker. This proves that Iran is able to export its crude, but it has problem with exporting naphtha on one side and its petroleum products on the other because of the Trump sanctions about 10 days ago. And what they hit the naphtha tanker and the methanol tanker. So to me, it is really a clear message on this one, but we should remember that Iran government and Iranian regime are not one. We are not looking at a monolithic unit here. We have the government that is under massive political and economic pressure. They basically are enjoying their lives as if there is nothing. They get all the money, they get all the businesses, they get everything. So like Joe said, it is elements of the regime that did that to make sure that those negotiations and the Japanese efforts basically to set up some sort of direct negotiations between the U.S. and Iran will not happen. Here is why it cannot be other countries. It cannot be other countries for a simple reason. The area where those tankers and the international water boundaries of Iran. So Iran basically got stuck here. Either they will say that they have no control of their waters and other foreign agents basically are in it, or they are defending the Gulf They are defending the Hormuz Strait, and therefore there are no foreign agents. So they cannot have it both ways.
Joe, what are your reactions to Anas's comments?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with actually what both Anas and Pat said. You know, I'd agree with Pat. The market has really yawned about these tanker attacks. And I think right now the market's sort of weighing a contest between concerns about the global economy and concerns about geopolitical risk. And right now, the global economy, mainly fueled by this U.S.-China trade issue, is really winning the day right now. But I think it's a mistake for the market to be, as Pat described in her opening, to be so heavily engaged on the short side, because I think we're going to see political risk continue and increase as we go through the summer and into the fall. I mean, what I just talked about Iran sort of raising the temperature in the region through, you know, their own market or maximum geopolitical chaos plan, it alone means that we're going to see more out of Iran. But you've got Venezuela is still standing out there. You've got Libya. You know, we saw this Russian pipeline thing come out of nowhere. You've got the Yemen rockets, you know, into Saudi Arabia. So I think we're going to see more of this. It's almost going to be like a geopolitical risk whack-a-mole. So I think the market better get ready and fasten its seatbelts, because I think at least we're going to see some equilibrium, at least with the global economy concerns. And we'll have to see, you know, what happens on the trade talks. Obviously, that changes the dynamic tremendously. But I really see geopolitics not just not going away, but also increasing. And it's going to be hard, I think, for the market to ignore that going forward. And by the way, those ships are, just so people know, those ships are still burning today. The fires have not gone out.
Let's talk about how all of this translates to market price and where it may be headed from here. Because one of the things, I'm just looking at a chart now, and it's really striking to me that the big spike up that we saw in reaction to the news of the tanker attacks coming out is really quite a bit smaller than the spike up that we saw this week in reaction to, I guess it was reaction to resumption of trade talks between U.S. and China, and probably ECB and some anticipation of Fed policy, things that are important but not directly related to the oil market. That's taken us back to the very top of the consolidation range that we've been trading in since the end of May. And if we look at where we are now in price, 54 spot 33, as we're speaking on WTI on Wednesday afternoon, that's just about the same as the high that we saw back on June 3rd. And it's almost as high as that peak that we saw on that gap up open that occurred on June 9th. So we're back up to the top of the range. I don't think we've really seen anything. Today's inventory report was a draw, but it wasn't that big of a draw. And, you know, we've kind of seen, as far as I can see, the world is still a little bit oversupplied with oil. We've got a lot of geopolitical scare in the system. But the fact that the trade talks with China are coming back online seems to me like that's not going to change the fact that the world is oversupplied with oil. Even a military conflict with Iran, Iranian production is not really affecting the market that much other than the so-called gray market. Do we really have reason for prices to go higher from here, or do you think that the downtrend resumes? Joe McMonagle, let's start with you. What do you think this means in terms of translating all this action to where the market's headed from here?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really see it as a supply, an oversupply problem. And I mean, I think the fundamentals are actually tight. I think we've seen rising inventories in the EIA data over the recent weeks. And I think that's really mainly attributable to refineries being down for maintenance. Now, normally they'd be down for maintenance, but they're taking a longer time to do that because they don't want to go into maintenance in the fall, because they want to be able to start ramping up full tilt to be producing this low sulfur fuel in preparation for the IMO 2020. So, I mean, look, I've talked to some refiners and they're actually concerned about all these refiners ramping up at the same time and potentially the price impacts it could have this summer. On the demand side of things, yes, OPEC and IEA and EIA have both come out with these gloomy demand forecasts. Or not, maybe not gloomy, but they've decreased the demand forecast. But all of that is based on the macroeconomic data. Whereas in the EIA data today, that was pointed out by some of our friends at EIA, the gasoline demand last month was the highest in a year since last August. So the actual numbers, which is really based on U.S. customs data, is quite strong. So I don't know that I would agree with the demand forecast. And then lastly, I think you've got to look at what Saudi's doing. I mean, Saudi Arabia's production is down by more than 1 million barrels a day from the fourth quarter of last year when we saw prices crash. The market's sort of yawning at that. You know, I think it's only because this trade issue is really winning the day in terms of the market narrative. But I think fundamentals are very much pointing towards a tighter physical crude market. And, you know, I don't know that that's going to go away anytime soon unless we have some kind of total breakdown in these trade talks.
And just for the benefit of any listeners who may not be familiar with Joe's reference to IMO 2020, we discussed that topic at some length in episode number 1 of Energy Week. Anas Alhaji, let's get your comments on how all of this geopolitical and inventory and everything else, how does it translate to what comes next for the market?
Well, Eric, if we see and look down, we have an issue to look at, because if we look at inventories on one side and spare capacity on the time series, where we have inventories and capacity that is larger than disruptions. So that tells me that the market is oversupplied, and this is reflected in prices today. You have all this political risk, yet prices did not move. In fact, it went down. When this happened before, it happened in the middle of the 80s. During the Iraq-Iran war, lost over 6 million barrels of oil. Political premium was extremely high. The tension was very high. People were afraid that the war would spread to other countries. Yet prices continued to decline day after day until the market collapsed. So this is the second time we are seeing something like this, where the inventories and spare capacity are high enough to compensate for all the political premiums and all the unplanned outages that we have seen on this one. However, on the other side, we have a major issue that happened last week, but people overlooked that, related to the data quality a couple of weeks ago in details for most of the program. And probably I'll just leave it at that, and probably we start the discussion after we hear from others.
Pat, do you want to comment on the price direction?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the break from the highs, 64.60, the break from that level was really very serious. And it's going to be difficult for the market to significantly rally for a while. And what I'm looking for is the market stabilizing at these levels and then jumping maybe to $57. But then I think, you know, the market will have some difficulty in rallying above that. And, you know, the Fed today announced really kind of cleared the way for lower rates. And I really think that the market is very focused on the macroeconomic picture and whether or not that's being measured in demand at this moment. I think that the market is really sort of discounting, or has discounted, the fact that, you know, we're in a bear market right now. So, I mean, sometimes we can get very violent rallies in bear markets. So it's a possibility that we can see that. And so I'm looking at $57 as a kind of key pullback. And, you know, as far as the fourth quarter is concerned, the IMO will be serious. And, you know, maybe we can stabilize with the $50 level, or maybe even a little bit below, and begin to build a base again. But right now, the market is looking very pressured.
Let's move on to our next discussion topic, which is really a potpourri of several different issues. We've got a number of changes that have happened in the last few days. First, the FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee, which is the U.S. central bank's mouthpiece, has told us that they are likely to cut interest rates perhaps at their next meeting, or at least that seems to be the hint. Meanwhile, the rumor is that finally there has been a resumption of trade talks with China. I've heard a few rumors that maybe around the end of the month, we might actually see some kind of deal come together. We've got the G20, we've got the FOMC policy, and meanwhile, IEA has come out with their 2020 outlook. As we look at all of these developments, so how do we pull all of these things together and develop an outlook for what it all means to energy markets? Pat Hemsworth, let's start with you.
Yeah, I think that the factor that's taken the centerpiece is really fears about a recession, a global recession. And yesterday, Draghi, who is the head of the ECB, indicated that he was going to be taking a stimulative approach, monetary approach. And then today, of course, we had Powell clear the way, you know, for a, as you pointed out, for a rate cut in July. And also the Fed funds markets are discounting at least two additional 25 basis point cuts this year. So, you know, markets are really looking for some help from central banks because bond yields have collapsed and the bond market is inverted. And, you know, so all of the signs, the typical signs of recessionary developments are beginning to show up. And so therefore, you know, I think that's really what torpedoed prices, probably not any near term, you know, dramatic oversupply or anything like that, but simply, you know, markets are anticipatory. So it's fear. It's real fear that the markets, that we'll see a severe downturn in economic activity. So, and I think we saw that just in the way the market reacted. Just, okay, so it was the Fed and also the fact that Trump and President Xi will meet in Osaka at the G20 meeting. That was really got a bounce out of the market, more so, as you pointed out earlier, Eric, more so than the developments in the Gulf. So, you know, I really think right now, the centerpiece of market activity is anticipation about what's happening in the macroeconomic environment.
And Joe McMonagle, what are your perspectives on all of these different factors that should somehow come together to affect oil markets?
I agree completely with what Pat is saying. And also, I thought your comment about oil spiking on the news that the meeting would take place between Trump and Xi, I think that's evidence that that's really what... What's the guidepost that the market is looking to. Look, I don't really follow trade, but I do have a close relationships in the administration and contacts. And, you know, I'll share a little. I was at a dinner last week with, you know, it was a small dinner, maybe 10 people, including a former Trump chief of staff. I won't say the name, but you know, there are only two of them. And also a former Trump economic advisor. And essentially what they both said was, number one, he's very serious about, at the time, this was the Mexican tariffs, where they were saying that he was very serious about the Mexican tariffs and didn't really care about the impacts to the economy. He just thought by principle, you know, that that was something that he felt he needed to do. And he was convinced also, by the way, that the Mexicans would capitulate to whatever he was asking them to do, but that's a separate matter. But on the trade topic, though, this economic advisor who recently met with Trump basically said, look, you know, we are seeing signs that the economy is slowing, and was kind of urging Trump to basically cut the best deal he can with the Chinese now and, you know, claim victory, which we know he will do. And then, you know, get reelected, because the economy is really more important to him than the trade tariffs are in terms of his reelection chances. And then in the second term, just, you know, start beating up China again and holding their feet to the fire. And, you know, the guy didn't say that Trump agreed fully, but he definitely was listening and to his advice. So we'll have to wait and see what happens. I don't think next week is being set up to be some big agreement. But I have always felt like it's in the best interest of both China and the U.S. to come to some agreement soon. And I don't think you can really time this, you know, to be next year. I mean, I think once the economy takes a nosedive on these fears, as Pat said, I think it'll be very hard to recover from that. So I think the pressure is on both China and the U.S. to come to some kind of an agreement.
And Anas Al-Haji, how do you assimilate all these different factors together?
Well, I am going to be very brief here. First of all, I think there is a lot of pressure on China too. as you heard from my colleagues, I just want to mention something about the agreement. All they want, they lowered the bar so much that any agreement, basically, they want any sort of agreement. For example, an agreement not to raise tariffs anymore. It's not necessarily a final agreement to reduce anything. So most likely, like Joe said, we are going to have an agreement at the end of June, but it's kind of very mediocre agreement, but it's enough to be kind of to help the market a little bit. Reaching a deal, generally speaking, is bullish. As they negotiate more and more and they lower tariffs, is going to be more bullish for oil. Flat or lower interest rates basically is bullish. The IEA forecast for 2020 is bearish, and I think they are completely wrong and off on this one. And there are many reasons why they are wrong. But let me give you just one example. I'm going to talk about the EIA. I'm not talking about the IEA right now, but the criticism is to the IEA. The EIA this week released the drilling productivity report. It is very clear that the EIA has been quietly revising down shale production in previous months in some place. For example, in the Permian, the sum of downward revisions since for the first 4 months of the year, get this number, 484,000 barrels daily, almost a 500,000 daily revision, downward revision. So all those high numbers that the media was going crazy with basically are not founded. For April, earlier estimates basically overestimated production by 112,000. In March, by 130,000 barrels a day. In the Eagle Ford, the sum of the downward revisions in the Eagle Ford alone in the first 4 months of the year is 192,000 barrels a day. April's Eagle Ford production is 57,000 barrels a day lower than earlier estimates. So you sum them up. Just in Texas, the downward revision is 700,000. So all those forecasts about this massive increase in shale that the IEA is talking about in 2020, already being proven by the EIA, is not going to be correct.
And I'll just throw in my own comments on this topic. I think that we are headed towards some kind of China-U.S. deal. I don't know what it will look like. It may not be the one that everybody wanted, but I think both leaders have more to gain by coming to some kind of deal than not coming to one. So I think something will happen. I also think that it's very likely that we'll see a 50 basis point cut from the Fed, probably at the July meeting. Both of those things ought to help oil prices, but I don't think for very long. Maybe that's what gets us back to that $57 number that Pat talked about. I think once we're there, I'm with Pat on the resumption of the bear market. If the inventory numbers continue to show this trend toward builds on inventory, and of course, that's a very big if, time will tell. In any event, listeners, we need your help putting the word out that there's a new podcast in town and that we intend to become the definitive weekly information source for energy traders, investors, and others interested in energy markets. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes or at macrovoices.com. And you'll also gain access to our Thursday night podcast, which has a much more general macroeconomic focus. We're also looking for sponsors so that we can keep all of our Macro Voices content free to the listener. To save time here on the podcast, I've prepared a detailed video explaining the opportunity for sponsoring Energy Week and other Macro Voices content. You can find the video at macrovoices.com/sponsor info. If your company is interested in sponsoring Macro Voices Energy Week or any of our other content, please email me at info@macrovoices.com. Before we close, I want to ask each of our panelists what they're going to be watching for in the week ahead in energy markets. Pat Hemsworth, let's start with you. What will you be looking for in the week ahead?
I'm going to be looking at price action. Also, I'm going to be watching the crack spreads. We got a very high gasoline demand number today, 9.98 million barrels a day demand. So we're starting to see the cracks increase. And I'm also watching distillate and distillate prices and spreads. And also I want to see what the funds are going to be doing. And, you know, I'm kind of wanting to see a rally, but we'll see. I'm just monitoring price action at this point.
Joe McMonagle, what are you watching for in the weeks ahead?
Yeah, so next week we have the G20 meeting, and because of everything we talked about and stressed today about the macro factors really impacting oil more than fundamentals, I think that's going to be crucial, and any kind of smoke signals that we get out of, you know, the China-US meeting, I think will be important. Also, next week, Iran has now said that they're going to sort of pierce the JCPOA, Iran nuclear agreement, by sort of increasing their enrichment of uranium. And so, you know, for the first time since the U.S. walked away from the agreement, Iran is now going to be violating at least what they agreed to with the EU. And so the question is, what does Europe do now? What does the EU do? There's a lot of, you know, talks between, I think today there was a call or a meeting between the EU foreign minister and Secretary Pompeo. I think you're going to see those talks continue, but that'll definitely have an impact on oil markets. And then, of course, we'll have a lot of statements leading up to the OPEC meeting next week. The meeting is early the following week, so we'll start to see some lots of interviews with ministers that may start to float some trial balloons on different topics. So that'll be what I'll be paying attention to next week.
And Dr. Anas Al-Haji, what will you be watching for in the week ahead?
Well, of course, like what Joe said, basically the G20 and, of course, all the OPEC minister statements before the official meeting in early July. I am also watching how the opposition in Canada basically are positioning themselves to oppose the Trans Mountain pipeline that the federal government just approved yesterday. I think this is really big news either way, and this is going to change the trade landscape in North America if it is built.
And before we let this week's panel go, I'd like to ask each of you to please tell our listeners where they can follow your work and learn more about what you do. Joe McMonagle, let's start with you at HedgeEye, sir.
Yeah, so HedgeEye.com, you can see excerpts of my notes. And of course, I'm a prolific tweeter and follower and retweeter of Anas and Pat. So you can follow me at Joe McMonagle. And just to, if I can give the podcast a plug from a tech standpoint, if you like the podcast, make sure you give us a rating. That'll actually affect the Apple algorithms and where they place the podcast when you start searching. So just a little plug for the tech aspect of the podcast.
Well, thanks, Joe. I should have mentioned that too. And listeners, rating and reviewing us on iTunes is so important in terms of getting recognition that helps us to gain the attention we need to bring you even more fantastic content. So please do help us in that regard. Dr. Anas Al-Haji, please tell us how our listeners can follow your work.
Let me make this statement here that I've been on Twitter for 33 months and I reached 33,333. And I was born on 3/3. You can follow me on Twitter at Anas Al-Haji, A-N-A-S-A-L-H-A-J-J-I. And you can check my articles and comments on my website, anasalhaji.com.
And Pat Hemsworth, what's your Twitter handle and how can our listeners find out about the newsletter that you write every single day?
I'm on Twitter and I'm fairly active on it, tweeting about what's going on in the market and also sharing things that I think are relevant and interesting. But so I'm at P. Hemsworth. That is my handle. And also for clients, I write a daily recap, market recap, which I send out in the morning. I'm happy to send it to any one of your listeners who wants it. I'm at P. Hemsworth at ParagonGlobalMarkets.com. So if your listeners send me an email and tell me what their interest is in energy, I'll be happy to add them to my list.
Fantastic. Well, thanks to all of our panelists for another excellent show. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend. See you next week, everybody.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.